Okay, we're back in Parshat Lech Lecha. Let's do, as we always do, a quick recap of how we got to where we are. We'll start from Noach. Noach and his children are going to come into play once again today. We had the world wiped out during the generation of Noach. We talked about how there was a move from before the Mabul, the pre-Mabul stage, which we refer to as the Ne'urim stage, the adolescent stage of the world, so to speak. The Mabul washes that away to the greatest extent that it can. It was supposed to wash everything away. Cham brings a little bit of the Mabul stage back to the new world post-Mabul. We come to the post-Mabul world, and we begin to rebuild from Noach. From Noach, we branch off into Shem, Cham, and Yafet. And we'll come back to them. We'll come back to them soon. From Shem, Cham, and Yafet, we get all of the nations of the world. That's the next paragraph that we see in Chumash. We talked about how they produce the 70 root nations of the world, and that's such an integral process that needed to happen. That when the world decided to try to create a reality of conformity and uniformity in a negative sense with Migdal Bavel, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu made sure that that wouldn't happen. God destroyed their ability to live in an entirely conformity-oriented society because there was a need for individualization, a need for every nation's individuality to be expressed in the form of the Shivim Umot Aulam, in the form of the 70 nations of the world. And so God produces the 70 nations of the world by breaking down Migdal Bavel, by breaking down the conformity to produce the individuality. One piece that I want to add in, which I neglected to incorporate into that discussion, just to put out there, is that it wasn't just that God was against the conformity of Migdal Bavel. In addition to that, God, part of the reality that we live in, the part of the history of the world, is that God is constantly pulling the strings of the world to move history forward. And God utilizes each one of the unique identities of those nations to push history forward as only that nation can. So the lack of individuality amongst the nations would have inhibited the historical process. So not only is it anti-Torah, we discussed, that conformity implies a lack of and a respect for the individual, but also conformity breaks down the emergence of the individual potential which needs to come out. But it's not just a problem on the level of suppressing free choice, of bechira chofshi, which is essential to humanity. But on top of that, it inhibits the ability for history to move forward. Because there's no individual unique components to be able to move history along as only that nation can. We'll come back to that later today and we'll see how that plugs in. So we break it down into the 70 nations. And we have our 70 nations, and then we have the Midrash, which I did find. It's the fascinating Midrash. It's in Bereshit Rabba Lech Lecha Parsha Lamed Tet, Medrash Yud, which talks about how how God, so to speak, the king, gives the mashal of a king who lost a pearl on the stand and sends his advisors to go and find that pearl. It takes the 20 generations of Abraham to Noach, and then the 20 generations from Noach, from Adam to Noach, and 20 generations from Noach to Abraham, for his advisors, so to speak, to sift through the sand and eventually find that pearl. And that pearl is Avram Avinu, right? And that's the end of Parshat Noach, which takes us all the way through till we finally produce that one person, the one singular, unique individual, that person who can live up to Lech Lecha, totally separate yourself out, be that individual, go and find truth, stand, be Avraham HaYivri, stand on the other side of the water, and stand against the world for ultimate truth, to become the 71st nation, the bearer of the 71st nation, that will produce that ultimate truth in the world. That brought us into Noach. Then we moved into Lech Lecha. God tells Avram to go forward. We noted, first of all, if Avram says, told Lech Lecha, go, by yourself, to yourself, for yourself, separate yourself, that it was odd that he seems to take Lot along for the ride. We weren't sure why Lot had to come along. He then goes to Eretz Yisrael, immediately goes from Eretz Yisrael, he goes to move it up to the inside. We talked about last time the journey of Avraham. He first goes to Eretz Yisrael. Then what's his second stop? He goes to Egypt. He's exiled to Egypt because of famine. He comes out by Rechush Gadol, the parallels that we made. Then he comes to the next stage in that process. The next conflict that happens is he has to separate from?
Lot.
He separates from Lot. Separate from Lot. After he separates from Lot, he then, because of Lot, gets embroiled in the world war of his time, in the four kings versus the five kings, in order to save Lot, who keeps coming back. Then afterward, we finally have Brit Ben Havitarim, where Avraham Avinu is promised two things.
Children.
He's promised children.
And the land.
Which he accepts wholeheartedly. Ve'amin ba'Hashem v'yachsheveha lo tzedaka. I believe it's the pasuk. Right? He fully, he's, I'm well past my childbearing years, so sorry, it's okay, God, I totally believe you, but when God promises Eretz Yisrael to his children, he says, how do I know? And so we pulled all of these pieces together. We talked about how really what links this is the concept of Ma'aseh Avot Siman Levanim, this overarching principle of the Ramban, that all of Sefer Bereshit is Ma'aseh Avot Siman Levanim, that they're basically the paradigm, the paradigms, the archetypes for everything that's going to happen throughout history. And that what's happening here is Avraham Avinu is actually walking through the historical process. Avraham Avinu asks God a question. He says, children, I believe. Listen, you're telling me, God, I can have children even in my late age, in my late age? That I accept. But how do I know that my children won't go off the derech? How do I know that my children will keep up to the standards that's required for Eretz Yisrael? I don't know. I can't be sure. They have free will. They have free choice. What if they don't choose the right way? And God says, I'll give you the answer in the form of a very odd procedure, which we now understand a little bit more of what that means. Take four animals, right? We talked about Brit Ben Havitarim. Take four animals, divide them in half. Keep the gozal, keep the dove, let's say, at the end, whole, and you're going to walk through these halves. And how all of the historical process is going to be defined by five unique kingdoms that are going to oppose Israel, that if Israel does make a mistake, if your children do mess up, they will be challenged, they will be thrown out of the land, they will have to define themselves against those other kingdoms. And as they go through that process, it'll be a process that will slowly but surely take them one exile through the next exile until they reach, until they eventually, by the end, achieve the completion, the full malchus, the kingship of godliness in the world. And so he says to Avraham, you already know that you can do this because you went to Israel. You set the stage. You were exiled to Egypt because of famine, which is the root of all exiles. It doesn't even get its own unique exiles. The root of all exiles stems from Egypt. You then came back. You then went and you defeated four kings, four kingdoms, your Dalet Malchiot yourself. That's where we see the potential in Avraham. And why did you go to fight them? To bring back Lot, who we said we need to have with us because contained within him are the seeds of?
Mashiach.
The seeds of kingship in Israel. So you will go and defeat the four kings in order to emerge, for the kingship of godliness to emerge. And then eventually you will inherit Eretz Yisrael. You and your children will be the ones to inherit Eretz Yisrael. That's where we came to last time. Questions, thoughts, concerns from the recap? Yeah.
I just heard something really nice over Shabbos.
Please.
And it reminds me of this. I think it's from a Nitziv. The question was like, why did Melech, Sodom and Melech, I think said that? Yeah, no. They gave like two different like prizes to Moshe. Like one of them was like, he's like, don't
take the problem.
To Avraham, sorry. Mm-hmm. To Avraham. Like, he's one of them said, I think Sodom said, like, keep, like, I'm my people, but like, take all my possessions. Mm-hmm. And the other Melech offered him like bread and wine. And like, why these two different gifts? Like, what do they symbolize, I guess, is that like Melech Sodom, like he was much like of a physical, he was like a physical man, and that like he thought that like somebody like Avraham, if he has to like fight in a war, you must like, even though he's this high spiritual person, like if you have to fight in a war, you become a physical person. So like he must want the people of, like he must want like all these possessions. Whereas like this other king was at like a much higher like spiritual level, and he knew that like even if somebody who is high in spiritual, sometimes we kind of like get our hands dirty and like do certain things, and like what are the two things that like that usually when you, let's say like take an apple, it's like it's a ha'etz, and when you squeeze it, it becomes a shahakol, it kind of goes down in a level of brachot. Mm-hmm. But with like wine and bread, it's like when you take the wheat, which is and you like grind it and you make it to like a lesser, it becomes like the bracha becomes higher, like lechem. Or like with grapes also, usually with grapes, it like you squeeze it, it's not just like a regular like ha'etz, I mean hazam, it's Hagafen. Mm-hmm. And like how like really he, because he was this physical person, like the brachos like rose, and like he also rose, and I just like felt like the, with like Avraham going through all these different steps, and like we're, he's like a paradigm for like us also, that his spirituality, like his high level, like him becoming physical is like important for us to realize, like we do live in this physical world, and like we do have to like fight in wars, and like we do have to like save boats, you know, and like do things like that, and like it becomes that like we're supposed to live in this like spiritual and physical area.
Fantastic. Excellent. Thank you for sharing. It was a great linkage. Excellent. Cool. Anybody else?
I'm scared to relay any part I ever heard at the Shabbos table again.
That conversation notwithstanding. Okay. So then what I would like to do is unpack a little bit more this concept, which we kind of sped through, we said that there's this concept of the Dalad Malchuyot, that embedded into history is this idea that there are four stages of exile. And to identify, clarify, as long as we have this moment where we have the paradigm of defeating the four kingdoms, which is really what contains all of history from the kingdom of Shlomo onward, meaning from the first time that we're challenged by the first kingdom, which is Babel, and takes us through the entirety of history. While we're in that, while we're talking about that, we're looking at the paradigm of that, just to unpack a little bit more of what the Dalad Malchuyot are. So we talked about the Dalad Malchuyot. These four kingdoms, I don't know why they're seven. These four kingdoms. We talked about how this isn't something which is just produced through the historical process, but we saw a medrash last time that talks about how it's actually embedded into the historical process itself from creation. Chazal link many things to the Dalad Malchuyot as representatives, as manifestation of these four stages of exile. But perhaps the most striking is that the medrash claims that it's already embedded in the second pasuk of the Torah, and embedded into the story of creation itself. Which four words, or which three words and four phrases did we say that the Dalad Malchuyot are linked to? Tohu, Bohu, Choshech, and Al Pnei Tehom. And we said that those are representative of the four Malchuyot, which are Tohu is
Babel,
Bohu is Pras and Madai, Choshech Yavan, and Al Pnei Tehom is
Edom.
Or we refer to as Edom, which we said could be broadened really to Western culture to this day. And how these four Malchuyot, these four kingdoms, they're not just kingdoms and they're not just kings, but what defines them as being able to be a legitimate Malchus is that they don't just dominate the world physically, they dominate the world on every level, physically, in terms of military might, but also culturally. The world was enraptured with the Greek lifestyle when Yavan was at its height. The world is living, I mean, we're even defining, now that Edom has fallen away as, you know, Edom in terms of a name, we define the Malchus of Edom as the kingdom of Western culture. When you have American products in Israel, it means that American culture is dominating. We have American music on the radio in Israel. When you're sitting, like I was very oddly, in an all Israeli, all Hebrew speaking yeshiva in the middle of the desert in the south, and in between yeshiva breaks, these people have been learning their entire lives, they're sitting there and singing American songs, where I was blushing and I realized that they just didn't even understand the words because they weren't English speakers, but because on the radio that was part of the culture, that's just what they were singing. I was like, just so you know, this is what the song means. You know, I mean, that was a really striking moment for me when I was in Shabbat. I spent a couple weeks in this yeshiva, and like, they had no idea that they were being permeated by Western culture. That it's not just a military might, it's also a military might. But it's a culture that permeates a large part of the civilized world. That's what allows for legitimate malchus. And we go through these four stages. But let's try to understand a little bit more about what these four stages are. And to do that, I actually want to come back to where they came from. Let's go back, and let's even add Mitzrayim there. We mentioned how Mitzrayim is sort of the root of all exiles, the paradigm on a national level of all the exiles what we're going to go through. Starting from Mitzrayim, who's linked to which one of the three branches that come from Noach that create the entire world? So let's start with Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim is a product of whom? So Ham produces Mitzrayim. You can check back in your genealogies in Perek Yud, right? We have Ham produces Mitzrayim. Who produces Bavel? Take a look back inside. Who produces Bavel?
Also Ham, no?
One fun friend, you sure?
Fun friend.
Shem.
Then it's Yafet.
Just kidding.
You take a look in Pasuk. In Pasuk Yud, Vatihi Reshit Mamlachto Bavel. Bavel came from Nimrod, Nimrod came from Canaan, and Canaan comes from Ham. You were 100% correct. I was just asking if you wanted to phone a friend. So we have Mitzrayim, and then also from Ham is going to come. That's going to Bavel. Next up is Pras Umadai. Do Pras or Madai appear in that paragraph? It's in the first three psukim of that paragraph. No? Perek Yud Pasuk Bet B'nei Yefet Gomer Umagog Umadai V'yavan. So, from Yefet, we have who? We have Madai, and presumably Pras. Persia is going to be connected to it. They're one Malchut anyway. Where does Yavan come from?
Yefet.
Also from Yefet. Who's left? Shame. And Shame is going to produce Edom. Where does Edom come from? Where does Edom come from originally? Esav is the beginning of Edom, and we know that the Jewish people come from Shame. So Esav also comes from Shame, and Edom inevitably also comes from Shame. So there seems to be a grouping here that the progression, as we saw, from Tohu Bohu Choshech al Panit Tehom, which is just, again, one of many examples. All the four kings, by the way, there's another midrash that actually links each one of the four kings to each one of the Malchiot. But that's a common theme throughout midrash. There are many fours that get linked to the Malchiot. So we see that there's a progression from Bavel to Pras Umadai to Yavan to Edom. What does this chart then tell us about the Malchiot? Think about what we talked about with Ham, Yefet, Shem. What is this all telling us then?
That they can infiltrate, maybe, like, for example, they can infiltrate us on all levels. So, for example, Ham with Mitzrayim and Bavel, they can do it, like, on a solely physical, carnal level. But with Yafet, like, Madai and Pras and Yavan, they try to, like, intellectually reach to the Jews and, like, and sports and, like, outward physical beauty, I guess. And then Edom would be the worst because they'll get into maybe your mind, like, spiritually, because they'll understand the essence of things and they'll try to twist what Jews believe in the essence.
Good. Keep going. Excellent. This is another one of... Excellent. I just want to hear more people also. Yeah.
Maybe it's also the idea of the progression, because Yafet was kind of ideologically closer to Shem than Ham, so maybe it means that Madai is harder for us to resist, and all the more so Edom is harder for us to resist because we come from kind of the same... sackcloth.
Good. It's very similar in terms of your descriptions. Excellent. Keep fine-tuning. What else do we have? Somebody else had their hand up, I think. If you have something to say, go for it. Yeah, please.
I was just thinking, Yishmael also comes from this, right?
Yes, that's an interesting question of what the nature of our relationship to Yishmael is, and we'll be talking about Yishmael over the next couple of weeks.
Okay, but I was thinking that a lot of the, like, Edom is it, that's the Romans?
Edom is, it's been connected to the Romans, to Christianity during those times, to and again to Western culture following that, with the fall of even the dominance of Christianity in that way.
And I thought it could be completely unrelated, but Christianity is like based off of Judaism, and so is
good.
Islam, which is
interesting. Yes, right. I want to keep Ishmael out of the question for a second, but yes, the point about Christianity is a very strong one.
Sure.
That's good. Excellent. The way that many people will present the Dalet Malchio is just taking everything that you said and kind of tying it together. Is they'll say, okay, what did Avraham Avinu ask in Brit Ben Abitarim? How do I know that my children are going to inherit the land? How do I know? And God says, don't worry. Even if they mess up, they may be exiled. That may force them to go out of the land where they'll have to mature and then come back. And a simplistic way of looking at it is, okay, so whenever we go to Eretz Yisrael, we make a mistake, we mess up, we're then dominated by one of the four Malchiot, we get pushed back, we do tshuva, we become better, we come back, and then if everything's fine, then we're good. But if we mess up, then God will just take some other random nation, come and put them on top of us, and push us back out into the process all over again. In a way that's not meaningful individually, meaning we just keep messing up, so we keep getting thrown out. And like it would just continuously go on and on and on and on. But there's no difference in terms of who actually is dominating us. It doesn't matter who the malchus is. What this tells us is that there has to be a process involved. That there's a progression involved. It's not just God randomly picking a nation to throw us out. And that brings us back to that point, which is what I wanted to fine-tune about the individualization of nations. Each nation is very unique. Each nation has a particular impact on the world. And what's happening here is that God, each time we make a mistake, God is putting us through a more finer process of self-definition with each exile that we're put into. So much so that, again, it's irrefutable. Because there aren't just four random nations that are picked. There are four nations that are sown into creation itself. In the words, Tohu Bohu Choshech Al Panei Tahom. They're sown into creation in this way, in this order. In order to produce a specific result with us over the course of time. Yeah?
So what does that imply? That we have to be making... That we're not making the same mistake over and over again, but that our mistake is getting progressively... less and less, and therefore...
It depends on how you look at more or less. It perhaps becomes more and more fine-tuned to help us define what that is. The word that we used earlier was maturity. Each one forces us to mature and come back, but mature on deeper and deeper levels. Is that better or worse? I don't know. They're different. But it's getting to more and more... We're getting closer and closer to making sure that we've clearly defined who we are as emerging... the bearers of the malchus of God.
But if we keep making the same mistake, then how...
Who says it's the same mistake? That's also possibly a misnomer. Okay. Same mistake. I don't know. We keep making mistakes. Mm-hmm. We keep not living up to the land. But if there's a bias rishon that's built by a certain individual and a bias sheni that's built by a different individual, are they the same? If one's around for 430... I want to say 70, 430, 410 years, and the other one's around for 70 years. If one of them has more Shekhinah, one of them has less Shekhinah, one of them has more miracles, one of them has less miracles, if one of them has all of Klal Yisrael in the same place and one of them doesn't, are they the same stages of history? Or do we just like to dump them both in the same category and say, Bayit Rishon, Bayit Sheni? But everything in Judaism is soaked with meaning. Everything in Judaism has to be understood in its own, both individually and by comparing and contrasting. So then we're doing the same thing with the Galiot. Originally, we're forced out by somebody, by people, by Mitzrayim, by Bavel. There's no intent, there's nothing, to a Jew, there's nothing really attractive about Bavel in a way that's drawing us in. Yeah?
So does it connect to maybe the reason why we went into that Galus for, like, so for example,
let me take it a little bit further and then we'll come back. Let's just see a little bit more of pieces to the puzzle. We start with Babel. Babel is a barbaric nation that comes and tries to physically dominate us and destroy us. Nobody's really interested in Babel, and even if they are, it's not something which is glorious to be connected to Babel. Prasumadai gets a little bit trickier. There are definitely people in the Purim story who are spending way too much time in Ahasuerus' parties, but still very immersed in the physical world, in a way where it's attractive, and we sort of then are identifying with Pras Umadai, but not to the extent like with Yavan. There's no such thing as meet Bavlim. There's no such thing as meet Parsim. A large percentage of the Jews became meet Yavnim. There was something so attractive about it. It was so much closer to who and what we are that we were willing to identify with that culture. It forced us to think way more critically about who we are in contrast to that nation. That's a big part of the struggle of Hanukkah. Yefet and Shem both go in to cover up the nakedness of their father, Noach, in the tent. For very different philosophical reasons, but they both go and do it. They both have an appreciation for there need to be beauty, for there need to be, that there's a beauty and a glory in knowledge, in philosophy, in art. One of the things that Chazal themselves learn from the phrase Yaft Elokim Liyefet V'yishkol Na'ol Hashem is that possibly, according to a mission, one opinion in the Mishnah, the Torah can even be written in Greek from that pasuk. We learn from that pasuk that there's a connectivity, there's some sort of identification that we have with Yavan when the external beauty is funneled in the right way. Yavan doesn't do it in the right way. It forces us to define in what way are we the same as Yavan to the extent that we appreciate external beauty, and what ways are we different in the fact that we don't appreciate it if it's only external beauty, and if it's external beauty on a level of pritsut. Sports aren't necessarily evil. Who mentioned that before? Somebody mentioned, like, it was you. Yeah. Sports aren't necessarily evil. Gladiatorial games with death, Olympic games, which were done totally without any clothing on, because if it was physically beautiful from the outside, what's the difference? With no understanding of tzniut, there are issues there that don't recognize a deeper internal reality. Forces us to define ourselves further. And then we come to the long extended exile of shame, which, Simi, I think you pushed us into that place. Edom has been identified many times with Christianity. Christianity was the first time that a nation came and opposed us and didn't say, I'm right and you are wrong, and I'm going to prove that you're wrong by crushing you. Or I'm right and you're wrong, whether it's by physical might, or I'm right and you're wrong philosophically. I'm right and you're wrong because I'm telling you not that the Jews aren't Jews, not that the Jewish people are wrong. I'm telling you that they're wrong and that they haven't just gotten the memo that we're the new Jews. You are us. You just didn't get the memo. That causes a lot more place for self-refinement, for critical thinking. What does separate us from that? If we say, even a phrase that often gets quoted in this context, Yaft Elokim Liyefet V'yishkol Na'ol Hashem, that there's a concept of beauty in Judaism, we struggle with it on an Edom level, on a Shem level, all the time. There's an external, beautiful world. There's so much in secular culture. Can we incorporate secular culture into our Jewish lives or not? And that's a very tough question to answer, especially if you start to try and parse out. There are so many Gedolim in previous generations who quoted from secular texts, who incorporated secular knowledge into their works, who used incredibly high-level English in their writing. Is that good? Is it bad? It's not clear. Edom forces us to really critically analyze to what extent that's part of us or that's part of them, to really define who we are as Jews. The process of the Dalet Malchios is a specific and intentional process of self-definition that causes us to slowly but surely become more and more and more and more and more clear on who and what we are, to define ourselves on the contrasting background of these nations in ways that we didn't previously have to do, to emerge as the clear bearers of the Malchus of Hashem. But it's a process. Everything in Judaism is meaningful. Everything in Judaism is intentional. And so too does Avraham Avinu defeat the four kings, all of whom represent one of those nations, And Avraham Avinu sets up, according to God, the four animals in a row, 1, 2, 3, and 4, also representing those Zal and Malchios, and walks through them one at a time until he reaches the ultimate destination, which is the revelation of God's Malchus in the world, which, as we pointed out, will come about through Lot, through David HaMelech and his descendants. But just to recognize that this process of Dalad Malchiot is integral to Chazal, it comes up all over the place in Chazal, because it's part and parcel of our history and what defines us as who we are. It helps us continue to define us in terms of who we are as a Jewish people. I'll take bracha first, she comes up for a while.
What does it say, though, that the majority of the Dalad Malchiot are from Yafet as opposed to from Shem? Why do we need two from Yafet?
I mean, there are also two from Cham. Question of why is there one from Shem, I do think it's a compelling question that Simi brought up, which is, you know, how does, if Yishmael is not one of the Dalad Malchiot, but we do struggle with Yishmael, and Yishmael does come from Shem. It's a good question. I mean, there's also what to think about even in terms of the definitions of what they are here. Toes, Obavel, Bo is Prasimadai, Choshech is Yavan, and we know very clear linkages between the fight for light and Hanukkah candles and the oil in the Beit HaMikdash versus the Choshech of Yavan. Al Pnei Tehom, what does Al Pnei Tehom mean? Yeah, if you knew Archbob Al Peh, which I don't know why I do, but it would say upon the surface of the deep, which is basically what you said, right? Upon the surface of the deep. It's not even self-defined. It's almost a culmination of those other three Malchiot, which is what it is. It's a combination of Bavel, Prasumadai, Yavan, and it's Al Pnei Tehom. It's extending very far for 2,000 years. Al Pnei Tehom, what does Tehom mean? It means the deep. The depths. It's incredibly deep and complicated and long. The words are indicating to us even the nature of what these Malchiot are about. And this Malchus of Edom is the longest, hardest, deepest of all the Malchiot to get out of. But that's also because Hatzileni Naam Yadachi Miyad Esav. He's my brother, he's Esav. I have to struggle with that. To what extent are we the same? Are we twins? To what extent could we not be more farther apart? As we even saw in the Medrash that we read in Mesilas Yesharim that the Ramchal quoted. Right, Yaakov says, I'll take this world, Esav, you take that. Yaakov says, I'll take this world, Esav, you take this world. And we'll get into those issues when we get into Parshat Toldo. And Vayishlach and Vayitze. We'll get into all of those issues. But that's the long, hard process of final self-definition. And it's a process that we all go through, even in when we're going through secular college in our classes. In secular college, there's certainly opportunities to indulge in Cham. We're presented with a lot of Cham. Physical desires, passions, things pulling us and telling us to go toward those things. And we need to reject those, which if we do, then we tend to feel guilty about them because we sort of know that they're wrong. When we get to the Yavans, it's so much harder. But it's an art class. But the philosophy is so compelling. But it's meaningful. But that book is written so beautifully. Unclear. And I'm not saying all of it's usser. I'm in no way poskening. That's not my point here. My point is the self-definition becomes that much harder. When you get to Shem already in Edom, that's when people look at you and they say, what are you talking about? We're the same. And you're not. And what are you? And what does that mean? When you get into those scenarios where you're looking at what looks like a mirror image of yourself, but something feels off. Something doesn't seem right. It's a reality that allows you, not in this context, but just the concept that we have, a Hanukkah bush. You wouldn't have that in another culture. You wouldn't have that with another one of the Malchiot. How can a Hanukkah bush exist? It's all the same. It's December. It's holiday time. What's the difference? It's all good cheer, but it may not be. And that may be a really big problem if we take a much more critical look. I mean, it is a really big problem if you take a critical look. But I'm saying that those are concepts, like we have Mit Yavnim, you can have a Hanukkah bush, but those are two different steps in a process that want us to think about when they keep engaging the world to define who and what we are. Two comments that we have from before. Yeah, I'll take ZC first.
It's a question more so. So I've learned before, and you mentioned also that a language that the Torah lost in writing is in Greek, right?
Potentially. Oh, it's anything in the Mishnah. Yeah.
And so when you were talking also about scholars or high Rabbi, and also intellectual pieces in English, you're saying English is more secular culture than Greek, meaning if it was written in Greek, it wouldn't be.
I'm saying no, they felt that clearly it was okay for them to write different Torah in English. But then the question is, how far do you go? and what is allowed and what is not allowed.
But meaning, but like English is considered a lot more secular, meaning like that adds a piece than like any other like language, like specifically like in like Greek or.
They're both secular. They're different types of secular. I don't think they're. My point was. Say again.
All Talmud-Godly's written in Aramaic.
Aramaic, which is at least a sister language to Hebrew, though.
But it wasn't that just opened up out?
Right. Yes, but nobody was doing it to be Babylonian in that way. I don't think that was the goal.
But that's what they spoke.
Deceder, my point is again, points for reflection of how we define ourselves against them. I want to leave the Dalai Malchus behind, take us one step further and leave us with an open question. Hopefully by then we'll be able to transition to Rambam. That's still the goal for today. I want to take us one step further. But do we at least have a better introduction here to what the Dalai Malchus represent?
Can I just ask, we're not going to connect to the reasons of why they went into those Galiot, like, for example, like Sinaspinam or like idolatry?
Not here. We're not, yeah, we have to get to, okay. We have to get through Chumash first. Then we have to get through Nevi'im, and then we have to, meaning, I wanted to take us a little broader out. My Rebbe did the same. My Rebbe did that, and I think it's an important piece because we see here the defeat for the first time of the representation of the Dalai Malchus, and this is essential to history. You can't understand Jewish history through the eyes of Chazal unless you understand the Dalai Malchus. But the question is now, and let's leave with this question, okay? Let's take it one step further and leave it on this question. We've done it. If Avraham Avinu is Maaseh Avot Siman Labanim, we've accomplished our task. We got to Eretz Yisrael, we went to Egypt, we survived the test of Egypt as the root galus, we come out Beruch Hushkadol, we separate from Lot, we lose Lot to the five galios, and then we defeat the five galios to redeem Lot, and we're given the promise of children in Eretz Yisrael, we do bring up Bitvein HaBitzarim, everything is good. What's the next, then, logical step? What happens next? We now know the whole progression of history. What should happen right now?
Avraham should have children.
Let's go! Right, let's get going. So who should he have? What should be the child that's produced?
Yitzchak,
which is exactly what happens next in Chumash.
No.
Except not. What happens next?
Ishmael.
So that's a big question for us. Meaning, this should, logically, everybody said the same thing, this should logically all bring us to Yitzchak. We've created the paradigm. We've created the archetype, the prototype. We've created the whole stream of history and answered all of our questions. Let's get to Yitzchak. Let's start Jewish history. But there's a stop that we seem to need to make along the way. And we're going to define that stop as Ishmael. So let's ask this. Put some theories on the board. Is that Miriam? All right. Okay. Let's take 1 minute of just thoughts. Let's free think for a second, and we'll pick up exactly from this point on Wednesday. What could the possible reason be for there to need to be a Yishmael before we get to a Yitzchak? There again, if we're assuming everything here is soaked in meaning and everything here is very intentional, if Yishmael comes before Yitzchak, it's because Yishmael has to come before Yitzchak. What is the function? What would the function of Ishmael be then? What could be the possible function of Ishmael? We've seeked, we've searched, we found Avraham, he did everything he had to do. What could be the function of Ishmael?
I didn't really develop it yet, never mind.
Maybe like even our children that are off the dial to serve
there. We're going to have Esav also, so why specifically Ishmael? Anybody? Think about it.
It's like the last stage. Like the last, like...
It's not the last stage. We have Yaakov also.
But like, I mean like the last stage before Yaakov.
Yitzchak's the last stage before Yaakov. And even not necessarily because also got Esav. Why Ishmael before
it's the fifth.
Yitzchak? There are only four.
But then
to show that someone else from shame can potentially not be good.
Good.
That mirror images, I don't know, like the brothers, that you find the same. Brother.
We spent 10 generations getting from Adam to Noah, and we spent 10 generations sifting through the stand to find the pearl of the individual who was Abraham and would fulfill Lech Lecha and everything we just talked about. We found the pearl.
And he has a shame.
What would Yishmael then be? Yeah.
Well, now it's a question of how Who will Avram fulfill that through? Will it be through Yishmael or through...
Keep it in the paradigm. I am pushing toward a particular answer in this particular case. Yes. I'm trying to force the thinking forward. Yeah.
The adversity of getting the land for the Jewish people.
Keep it more local. Don't go so broad.
I've heard that, like, Avraham needed to be, like, further refined. So, like, any part of Avraham that couldn't be in the Jewish nation kind of ended up in Ishmael.
If Sippy's nodding, it means that we got somewhere, right? It took us 20 generations to sift through the sand to find Avraham Avinu. And Avraham Avinu is going to be the father of that 71st nation. However, that doesn't mean that within the pearl itself, to rephrase what Sima just said, within the pearl itself, there are impurities that we're going to have to remove. And so the next process that we're going to go through is the refinement process of removing those impurities from the system within the line of Avraham Avinu in order to eventually get, stage after stage, to Yitzchak and then to Yaakov.
So is Yitzchak perfect?
If he were perfect, we wouldn't have to remove Esav. And it's going to be a step-by-step process. When we get to Yaakov, then we've got something to talk about. But the next progression of where we're going is discussion of the removal of those impurities from the system. In order to do that, we're going to have to define the system itself. And on a certain level, next week will be a Kabbalah 101 session. So for those people who are interested in those topics, we're going to be taking a much broader view, understanding Avram's place in the scope of certain Kabbalistic paradigms, and also then understanding what the place of Yishmael is there as well. It's going to be a really exciting shiur on Wednesday. And we're going to try to start Mamash at 3:05 so we can get the whole time in. I'll take questions afterward. We're going to pass it off to Miriam so we can get going on Ramah.